ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's over 2 metres over the last record, which was 2019. And then you think an extra 2 metres up the valley there on the right, which is, 2 kilometres away, the extra volume of water to fill another 2 metres of river up is phenomenal. It's impossible to imagine that volume of water.
The iconic Daintree River draws visitors from around the world for its pristine beauty and incredible diversity. But it didn't escape the wrath of the December flood disaster in far north Queensland. We'll head there shortly. And Sylvia Tack was watching ABC News when she saw something that took her breath away.
My cousin, he rang me and he goes, "Guess what? I seen some photos on ABC. They're our ancestors. That's our family. That's Jurukaya." I just couldn't stop smiling, like, really?
Now, the breakthrough identification of her great-grandfather is shedding light on a little-known chapter of Australia's history. I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk country, Perth. Last year, ABC journalist Erin Park reported on a set of mysterious black and white photographs that were found in a dusty museum collection in Italy. They showed a group of young Aboriginal men and a child living in Indonesia in the 1870s. It raised a lot of questions. Who were the people? And how had they travelled to Indonesia years before white settlement of the remote northern coastline? Well, a year on, and there are some answers that are now the subject of a documentary on the ABC TV program Compass. Here is Erin Park, firstly speaking with Sylvia Tack from Groot Island in the Northern Territory.
The Wurrumapa family was enjoying quiet time at home at Groot Island on Australia's far north coast when they saw something that shocked them.
My cousin, he rang me and he goes, "Guess what? I seen some photos on ABC. They're our ancestors. That's our family. That's Jurukaya." I just couldn't stop smiling, like, really?
The photos were taken in a studio in the Indonesian city of Makassar in 1873. They corroborate written accounts of Indigenous people travelling to Asia long before British colonisation of their country, sailing away with the Asian fishing crews who were visiting the northern coast for hundreds of years. The family can't be 100% sure, but they are convinced that it is their great-grandfather Jirakai in the photos, due to the scarification, physical resemblance and oral history.
They lived overseas. They travelled overseas before the non-Indigenous people came to us. It's like a love story. Jirakai went to Indonesia. He had a wife and children. I want to make that journey over there and meet these people.
They're now trying to locate Jirakai's descendants. Helping them in Indonesia is Lynette Russell, who's heading an international research project investigating early contacts on the Australian continent.
It's extremely likely that there are descendants of Aboriginal people here in Makassar, and it is extremely likely that there are descendants of Makassan sailors in Australia.
She's dug up written reports of Aboriginal people being seen in Asia as early as the 1600s, and she's fascinated by the black and white photographs.
These photographs are an astonishing record of the visitation of Aboriginal people to Makassar. It's always going to be difficult to identify people in the photographs. We do have to go on body scarification, the cultural markings, but we're very lucky because we've also had people who recognise the family resemblance, so that's going to be something that we can work with as well.
Lynette agrees that Jirakai most likely sailed to Asia voluntarily.
Understanding why some people would have decided to travel on the prowls with the Makassan sailors back to Makassar. A thirst for adventure, excitement. You get asked by your friend who you've developed a good relationship over a number of years. He says, "Come back to my country, you can sleep in my rooms, we can have adventures together." And I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think it was very appealing to a number, particularly Aboriginal men. We do know Aboriginal women also travelled here, but we've probably got more evidence for the men.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Oh, good.
And in the port city, Professor Russell is discovering local families trying to locate their relatives in Australia. Gahardudin Liwa's great-grandfather was a fishing captain who's believed to have had an Aboriginal wife and children during his decades visiting Arnhem Land in the 19th century.
I really want to meet them. The most important thing is to meet them and complete the family tree with my Aboriginal family.
What's remarkable about Pak Kahar's family is that what they're saying is almost identical to what the families in Northern Australia are saying, which is that they know they have relatives overseas. They're desperate to connect with them. But there is urgency to this, because with every generation, the knowledge and the memories of what occurred is being lost.
For now, the Wurrumurrupa family, proud their ancestor, is helping shed light on a little-known part of history.
I want to make that journey over there and meet these people, see what I can find.
That was reporter Erin Park speaking with Andiliyakwa woman Sylvia Tack about her ancestor who travelled to Asia in the mid-1800s. And you can watch the half-hour Compass documentary anytime on the ABC iView app, and you can see photos from that story on the ABC News homepage.
ABC Australia Wide.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company on this Easter Monday. If you're living in a city or town, mobility aids for the elderly and people with disabilities usually involve wheelchairs, walkers and scooters. What happens when you're on a rural block where none of those items can handle the rugged terrain? That's the case for William Baker. There is $64,000 sitting in his home care package account, but his full-time carer and daughter can't get the one thing she believes would give her dad quality of life, a side-by-side all-terrain vehicle. Jennifer Nichols has the story.
We usually have a game of gin rummy. Hey, Dad, how much do you like gin rummy?
Good.
It's good, isn't it? You're pretty good at it now? You win most games?
Yeah, I'm learning it.
You're learning it.
As his full-time carer, Atlanta Baker tries to make every day a good one for her 71-year-old dad. They rent from their friend and neighbour, living on a peaceful rural property in southeast Queensland's Mary Valley.
He does have days where he's pretty lucid, and they're great days. But other days not so.
Sadly, the last time Atlanta Baker took her dad to a public park, it was one of the bad days. She says his paranoia spiked and he scratched his arms until he bled, attracting a crowd of people and an ambulance, which further stressed him out.
My dad has Korsakoff dementia, but he also has bipolar 1 extreme. But he also had a serious car accident about 15 years ago, which has left him pretty well unable to walk.
Paranoia episodes, cognitive and physical decline have meant that life for William Richard Baker has pretty much been confined to his one-bedroom brick house and patio.
Dad's now having more bipolar days and Korsakoff days, and that's because we all lived through COVID. We know what it was like. We were climbing the walls after a week. Well, he's been in there nearly a year, and it just makes it, I don't mean to sound selfish, but then it just makes it so much harder on me, because when the bipolar hits, the paranoia hits, he starts thinking things and it gets a bit crazy.
Mr. Baker is now too old to be eligible for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and his conditions are complex.
I used to be able to put him in the car, but because of his ankle injury, I can't do that now, and I have no way of getting him off this pad of concrete or out of those four walls unless I have something that I can drive. We live in goat territory here.
His wheelchair is useless on this steep rural terrain, and his daughter says his cognitive challenges, physical injuries, and fluctuating mental state mean it wouldn't be safe to let him drive a mobility scooter, even if one could handle their hills.
The more he's in here, the more he finds it harder to go out. So before that progresses anymore, I really want some kind of intervention so he doesn't become too recluse in here.
Around $64,000 of unspent funds are sitting in William Richard Baker's Level 4 home care package.
That's because I do all his services. I wash Dad, I clean, I do everything for Dad, and have done for the last few years because he's needed that. And because of his bipolar, just a lot of complications there, so I'd just rather handle all of that.
Ms. Baker would like some of her father's package to be used to buy a side-by-side all-terrain vehicle, or ATV, with a roof cover, a roll cage and seat belts that she could drive for him.
What do you think, Dad? We could go down and have a cuppa near the dam together. It would be good, yeah?
Yep.
And if you could go over and maybe have a beer with a neighbour, that'd be good.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be something that on your sad days make you a bit happier?
I think so.
Yeah. It's not like I'm asking for more funding. I'm doing everything that that funding would normally cover. All I'm asking is, hey, can we use it? He can't use a scooter. Can I just use it for an ATV?
A spokesperson for the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commission has told ABC Rural that ATVs are considered vehicles, not mobility aids, and the purchase of them is a program exclusion. But Ms. Baker says her father's home care program provider, which she has requested the the ABC not to name, has written to the Aged and Community Care Providers Association to ask if an ATV could be considered an allowable expense given its direct relation to the consumer's care needs and the exceptional benefits to his mental health and well-being.
Looking online, new side-by-side ATVs retail anywhere from $7,000 to $31,000. Atlanta Baker is urging authorities to consider broadening the policy framework to provide more flexibility for people living in rural areas.
There's a lot of needs that a lot of people need rurally that perhaps people who live in towns and cities don't need so much but do take for granted.
Ms. Baker explains that they are renting from a close friend and moving is not an option that they can afford.
And his options are limited where he can go because of his, you know, it's not like he can go into a lovely retirement village. So it's just frustrating because I've uploaded photos, I've uploaded footage and I'm like, can someone just listen, please, and help?
Rebecca Koch is the Advocacy Manager for Aged and Disability Advocacy Australia and says while she can't comment directly on Mr. Baker's case for privacy reasons, she hopes his individual circumstances would be taken into account.
Traditionally, I guess the mobility aids that are out there are intended to be used by the individual, but I think that in a situation where the person is unable to utilise that piece of equipment themselves, there should be provision made into how they can actually have their needs met. If they are in a rural area, if they aren't able to use flat roads with that piece of equipment, then that should be looked at in terms of what is the best arrangement for that person.
Mr. Baker is unable to dress, groom, shower, prepare food for himself, or walk more than a few metres with his mobility walker. Rebecca Koch says that mental health and well-being are supported when people can get out of the house.
And that is the intent of the home care package program as well. It is about people having social connection and avoiding also entering into an aged care facility prematurely.
Atlanta Baker, who lives with prolapsed discs in her back, is also working to privately pay for renovations to her father's cramped bathroom, where a transfer seat is needed to reach the shower located over the bath.
We'll get to a stage very soon where I'm not going to be able to shower Dad in the bathroom, so that's a bit worrying. I actually cried. I was just like, oh, you get to the point where you're so frustrated.
Jennifer Nichols reporting there. Let's head further north now to far north Queensland, where the December floods not only devastated thousands of homes, it was also a disaster for one of the world's most iconic tropical rivers and the species and communities who rely on it. Tour boat operator Alex Pavlov takes our reporter Charlie McKillop for a cruise on the Daintree River to show her that beyond the destruction and despair, there's still beauty to behold.
The Daintree River is such a majestic place, a meandering mangrove river bounded by one of the oldest continuous living tropical rainforests. It's suffered unprecedented damage in the floods, an ecological and economic body blow, as I'm finding out on this boat cruise on one of the world's truly great tropical rivers.
Keep an eye along this right-hand side. There's been a 3-metre crocodile that's been hanging around here. May come out to do a bit of basking. The water's pretty cold from the recent rain, which is in our favour today for crocodiles.
Yeah, the promise of a glimpse of a notoriously shy saltwater crocodile is undoubtedly one of the draw cards for any tourist on the Daintree, not to mention locals like me. But it's the visual clues that paint such a compelling picture of what happened here just a few months ago.
There's a little creek we call the Bywash. On the right-hand bank, as we go in, you'll see there's a fairly tall, dead-looking tree leaning out. And in it, there's a bit of a log stuck in the top. That wasn't the height. Like, it went higher than that. That was on the way back down again. So I think officially at the village, it was 14.85. If you actually go upstream, it was higher again once you get up to Joe Baird's Corner, where the river's narrower. It's over 2 metres over the last record, which was 2019. And then you think an extra 2 metres up the valley there on the right, which is, 2 kilometres away, the extra volume of water to fill another 2 metres of river up is phenomenal. It's impossible to imagine that volume of water.
We've seen how devastating the floods are in an urban landscape, as shocking as that is to see people's livelihoods and their homes and everything in it, you know, basically pushed out onto the curbside, ready to be collected. How does that contrast with the devastation that you see in nature?
Yeah, it's equally as devastating. I mean, because we see this, the same river every day in the same parts of the river, and we get to know the animals that live there. And that first trip on the river after the flood was pretty depressing. Probably worse because everything still had mud on it. It looked a lot browner than it does now. It's starting to green up and look a little bit fresh again. But that first trip on the river was kind of like, do we actually still have something to show people here? Fortunately, it's a rainforest. It grows fast and the mud washes away and the leaves grow back and then it starts looking good again. And the wildlife's pretty resilient. The birds have come back and the crocodiles have come back. We'll be low on numbers of snakes and we'll be low on numbers of frogs and things like that for a little while, but it's kind of sad to see what's happening to the wildlife, yeah.
Does the memory of what happened here, does it kind of fade away?
Yeah, a little bit, but there's still holes where you know there was a big old tree that's not there anymore, or there's a little bit of bank that's not, you know, a little bit of habitat that's not there anymore, so you sort of get reminded as you go along. Because we do this same stretch of river regularly, we know what lives in each tree, and knowing that a tree's gone knows that that's a home for some things that aren't there anymore, so you're always getting a bit of a reminder, but it's still a beautiful place and it's still plenty of wildlife. So,
as our boat tour guide Alex Pavlov expertly edges along the riverbank, I'm sitting right next to an avid river watcher, ornithologist and ABC Radio bird talkback guru Del Richards. Even he finds the scale of the flood hard to fathom.
The essence of power that's behind what happened here, you can't even get your head around. Having been here for 29 years off and on, I've seen in all states, and to see it like it is now, you just can't really get your head around what happened. It's just the power associated, and where we're talking about the gap in the rainforest down here, that is the water just trying to get back in the river. The general loss of what was here, people are going to take a while to get used to it, particularly if they've seen it before. But those people, it will always be the danger. The ones that haven't been here before, it'll always present itself as being somewhere special.
Is that why you keep coming back?
It's real easy to come back to this place. As I said, I've been coming here for 27, 28, 29 years, and I've just seen it to every mood. And some days it's that windy, you wish you weren't here, and other days you just see it like now, you could spin a stone across the river. It's quite amazing. It's muddy today and there's froth all over the river and I've never seen it like this before. And it's just incredible amount of rain somewhere upriver somewhere last night. It's obviously that it's saying to us now that I am in proper flood to see this colour.
No, horizontal branch, yeah. Looks like a bit of flood debris, but...
Yeah. Oh, it's a frog mouth there.
Oh, yeah, I see it. I got it.
See the branch? It's got a white grey.
Yeah.
Hang on.
It's perfectly disguised.
Bloody hell, look at that. Look at that, that's incredible.
My name is Mandy Coxon. I run Mossman Gorge Bed and Breakfast in Mossman, and I moved to the area in 1988. And I love it up here, and I can't think of anywhere I'd rather live. And I must say, the Daintree, it just feeds your soul. It's beautiful. It lights up the light around you, the mountains, the clouds, the water. It's beautiful.
You happy to be a tourist today?
Yeah, oh gosh, yeah. I don't get to do this very often. So when I do, I really enjoy it.
Is it with mixed emotions? Because as you explained, you're a business owner who relies on people coming here to visit and take in the wonders of the Daintree and the other special things for which we're renowned around the world, but it's copped a battering just lately. How are you feeling about what you've seen today and how you'll be projecting that to your guests when they're asking you what they should see when they come here?
Yeah, that's a big question. It is a worry because they're expecting pristine, they're expecting what they see on the brochure, and that's not what they're going to see. There's not much we can do, but we can just hope that the people will still come and still see what beauty is here. Maybe they'll see it in a different way, that nature can be harsh, but it will recover, and we know it will.
Charlie MacKillop with that story from the Daintree. And finally, let's head to WA, where the Country Women's Association is thinking about opening its doors to men. The CWA in Western Australia will be celebrating 100 years of service in July, and to mark the milestone, some branches are reflecting on past achievements and also looking to the future. Our reporter Kate Forrester headed along to a CWA event in Pemberton in the state southwest for a cuppa and a scone.
I use 3 cups of flour and a cup of cream and a cup of lemonade, actually.
I'm about to get a rundown on how to make the perfect scone.
Then roll it out. Don't knead it. Otherwise it makes them hard.
I'm in Pemberton for the CWA Centenary Celebration. A morning tea open to all, with many of the members who are a part of the Women Only branch in attendance.
I'm from Thailand. I live here 5 years. Yes, and when I first moved here, my accent and my English wasn't this good. And my husband said, you should hang out with Australian women.
40-year-old Tita Baldock is one of the youngest members of the local branch, finding a sense of purpose and belonging in the organisation.
It's a, how can I say, sisterhood. Like, how can I say, it's like a group of lovely ladies that helping each other and always laugh and always, you know, tell stories. And I learn a lot from them as well.
What are some of those things you've learnt?
What is the best wine?
It's a similar experience for 101-year-old Rachel Mitchell, who was recently made a life member just down the road at the Donnybrook CWA. She loves to think back to what it was like when she first joined.
Oh, yes, you always wore your stockings and your gloves and your hat, and that was part of being dressed up in those days. It certainly wasn't as casual as it is these days. I'd lost my husband and I was looking for more interest in town, I suppose.
For someone like Rachel, she's seen a lot of change happen over the past century. But what is the next 100 years going to look like for this organisation?
Well, we'll get little aeroplanes to fly here and there, I don't know.
I get the idea that the CWA State Chief Executive, Trish Langdon, senses a bit of change in the air.
An organisation has to remain compliant with the current laws. So that's one of the major drivers of this. The second thing is to make sure that the organisation is governed in a contemporary manner, so we're changing some of that.
Trish Langdon is speaking there about their CWA State Conference, which is coming up in July. There's going to be some big points of discussion on the table.
We're considering having associate members, males as associate members. We have had a long history of men contributing to the CWA right from the word go, with members, they were either forced into helping keep buildings maintained or grass clipped or whatever.
Do you think there's mixed emotions about that, Trish, from members?
I think there are some members who say, you know, they think it's very important to keep it as a women's only organisation.
Back at the Pemberton Morning Tea, President Pat Nock is a little uncertain about the idea of men joining.
That's a bit hard one. Like I said, if they bring it in, well, they'll bring it in. We'll have to abide by the rules. But like I said, personally, I think it's nice for ladies to have somewhere to go to get away from the men, and the same as men get away from the ladies and have their own things. I know it's the modern thing that everybody should integrate, but I'm old-fashioned and think that we do need to have our own space.
To use the term that you used, old-fashioned, being old-fashioned, is that going to allow the CWA to keep going?
I think so. I think there's a place for everybody. I'm old-fashioned in that I refuse to go on the internet. I refuse to have a computer. I'm also, if we get men in, I'll welcome them in. There'll be there's no animal. I won't leave because, oh gosh, men are in, I'm out. None of that. No, I'm not anti-men at all. But, I just like the CWA the way it is.
So I guess time will tell if this club, which is built on the ideas of sisterhood, will change or stay the same. But for now, it's about serving tea and scones to the Pemberton locals, and maybe a few for the ladies in the kitchen as well.
Have you tasted one yet?
Yes, I have. I've been eating a few at home.
Pemberton CWA member Kate Shaw ending that report by Kate Forrester. And that is Australia-wide for this Easter Monday. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. I hope you can join me then. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.